Today is Monday, January 23rd, 2023. This is part one of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Donald Davis, last name spelled D-A-V-I-S. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Donald. How are you today?
As well as can be expected.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Don't be so glad. I don't feel all that well.
Well, it could be worse.
Yes.
Yeah. Donald, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Donald, what year were you born?
1938, April 9 to be exact.
And where were you born?
That's an interesting question, more than it usually should be. It happened that when I was ready to be born, my parents were living in Holly, Colorado, far southeastern part of the state, and I had presumably been conceived in Holly, Colorado, but there was no hospital in Holly, so they went to Syracuse, Kansas, across the border to actually have me. So technically, I was born in Syracuse, but personally, I think I qualify uniquely for the Colorado semi-native bumper strip.
Absolutely. Absolutely, you do. What were your parents doing in Holly?
My father was a high school science teacher and sports coach, and my mother a housewife in that household.
Okay. Did you have any brothers and sisters?
I have a brother, Gerald Davis, still living, 15 months younger than I am.
Okay. So you were the oldest?
Yes.
Do you know how your parents met?
I don't actually know, except that at that time they both lived in Iowa, although not in the same town, and I never thought to ask how it was that they hooked up with each other, but they ended up then moving west. I don't know just when, probably during the Great Depression.
Okay.
And Holly, I think, was the first. Well, let's see. No, that's wrong. My father attended the Greeley Teachers College, so that would have been before we were in Holly, so I must have been already. This is interesting. I never thought about that myself. But they evidently were in Colorado before they were in Holly.
Okay. And your dad, the Greeley Teachers College, was that a bachelor's degree in education, or was that a master's? Do you know?
I don't actually know.
Okay.
My father never made a point of it.
Okay. And did he ever tell you why he wanted to be a teacher?
Well, the only thing I can remember him saying at some point that has a bearing on that is that he once said, when I was listening, that he wanted to leave the world a better place than he found it.
Oh, nice. Nice. Did your mom or dad ever talk about any family stories that were really important to them that you recall?
Not that I recall. They weren't especially loquacious about their personal activities in the past.
Okay. Okay. And did you grow up there in Holly? Did your parents?
No, I was there for parts of 4 years, and then the third and fourth of those years, we spent summers in Manitou, Colorado. And there, in fact, is where I became primed to become a caver in later life. My father took the family on a tour of the Cave of the Winds when I was 4 years old.
Oh, wow.
And I remember walking along the trail in the Cave of the Winds, and every time we'd pass a junction, I kept wondering, where does that go?
Oh, wow.
And little did I know, at that farther by digging.
Nice.
But that was a long time afterward.
And you were 4 years old at the time. So did your parents move to Manitou?
Not permanently. Those were summer jobs. My father was trying to get there. But starting about that time, we did move, but out of state. There, we spent part of 1 year in Globe, Arizona, the mining town.
Oh.
And
what was that like? Do you have any memories of that?
I have one or two. I remember watching a parade, I think, in the street, and I remember thinking my favorite number is 9, and that's when I thought that, but I have no idea what the context was.
Huh.
My mother was very punctilious to tell the two of us to shake our shoes out every morning before putting them on, because there were a lot of scorpions in that region. But we weren't there very long. I didn't actually see what a scorpion might be. But then, when I was around 5, we moved to Eugene, Oregon, where the house we lived in had burned sawdust. There was so much logging going on around there, did then, but people's houses actually could have sawdust furnaces.
Wow.
And I do have a funny little story concerning that, but the furnace was in a back room in the middle of a chamber there, and it had these sort of ledges around the base, and I was in there one day, and something exploded nearby, and I looked around the corner, and here was this thing on the shelf of the hot furnace with all these fronds sticking out of it, and this, I thought, must be a scorpion. So I yelled for my mother, and it turned out that what the object had been was a golf ball that got overheated on there and exploded.
Oh, my. Huh.
And I've never seen what was inside a golf ball, but I thought that anything that startling and scary might be a scorpion.
Good enough. Huh. So when I think of Globe and I think of southeastern Colorado, I think of pretty dry country. And then when I think of Eugene, I think of water.
Yeah.
Did you make that transition smoothly?
I did anyway.
Okay.
I didn't see anything particularly odd. Of course, I hadn't spent long in Globe, and I hardly ever got around Globe unless they took me somewhere.
Okay. Okay.
But I still have a souvenir or two from their presence there, one of which is a copper replica of a Saguaro cactus.
Oh, my.
Ashtray that they got at Globe. But then in Eugene, I didn't get around a lot either. We made one trip to Crater Lake, as I recall. And I remember a catalpa tree on the way to my school. It was just a block and a half walk to the kindergarten and then the grade school where I did the kindergarten and the first 2 grades.
Okay. Do you remember, was there a lot of logging going on? Were you seeing logging trucks going by at the time?
Not in our residential streets. But there had to have been a lot either going on or very recently having gone on to feed the sawdust furnaces.
And this would have been the war years.
Yes, I remember the end of the war happened when we were in Eugene. I remember that when the surrender happened, my family and others came all out into the streets, and there were churches that still had church bells then, and all over town, the church bells were rung.
Wow.
And my father had a Model A automobile at that time, Model A Ford. I remember riding in the rumble seat.
Oh, nice.
That. Also, I remember my father starting the thing with the crank.
Okay.
Really a primitive automobile, it seems today. But that's what he had.
But it was cutting edge at the time.
Not quite, really. I would classify my parents as being lower middle class, if you have to put them into such a class.
Okay.
So my father didn't have new cars at that period. He would get old ones. But I think that got traded off because when I was age 8, approximately around 1948, we left Eugene and moved back to Colorado, and I'm sure we had a somewhat newer car going back there. I don't think the Model A would have been big enough anyhow. And but this time, we ended up the Arkansas River, as we pronounced it in that area, to Los Animas.
Okay.
And that's the one I consider my hometown. I went through the 3rd through 7th grades there. And it, at that time, was a relatively prosperous farming community along the lower course of the river there.
So this is downstream from, I'm trying to think of Pueblo?
Yes, downstream from Pueblo and Rocky Ford and La Junta.
Okay.
And Los Animas hasn't fared all that well in more recent times. A lot of the irrigation water has been bought up by richer outfits farther upstream, and farming is not what it was at that time.
Okay.
I've only been back there a couple of times as an adult, but it's a fairly depressing little town now with no particular signs of prosperity. But at that time, I did a lot of walking both around the town and up to a couple of miles west out the gravel road that led through the farmland there. And I loved to be outdoors. It was a flat country and would be thought of by many people as unscenic. But I remember walking with the cumulus clouds up in the sky and imagining that looked like foam rubber, and if I could just get up there, I could climb on the cloud.
Wow, yeah. Nice.
But I had a few friends in grade school there that we would pretend that we were Indians and went out to this place where an oxbow in the river had been cut off and the river straightened, and that left the island basically that had, it was at times completely surrounded by water and other times that you could just walk across the original stream course, and I called that Apache Island. There had been a lecturer come through Los Animas while I was there who lectured on Indians and their primeval customs.
Hmm.
And I was quite intrigued and rather wished I could have been one, so we wandered around among the tamarisk brush and cottonwoods, having fun toy things there.
Nice. Did you, your summers, did your family travel? Did you do the, you know, station wagon kind of thing eventually?
Well, we never had a station wagon, but my parents belonged either to Methodist or Presbyterian churches, depending on what was locally available. And I grew up in small towns pretty much exclusively. And so anyway, the Methodist Church in Los Animas had a summer camp near Palmer Lake, Colorado, called Pinecrest, and we were able to spend, I think it was two summers, spending about a week in Pinecrest. There were ponderosa pines and rustic cabins on the little roads running along the hillside there. And I was delighted in the place. It made me want to spend more time in mountains. And in fact, that was where I first climbed a mountain, Mount Chautauqua, behind Palmer Lake. And I never got enough of these outdoor things at that time. So later on, I built on that background.
Where is Palmer Lake, roughly?
It is north of Colorado Springs, about 20 miles.
Okay.
Two railroads used to run through there, and now it was united into one some years ago.
Okay. All right, so that's north of Colorado Springs, so north of Pikes Peak then, but sort of west up in the Front Range there, up in the mountains there?
It was not exactly in, it was right at the very border of the valley that extended out toward the eastern plains.
Oh.
And there in Pinecrest was right at the edge of the ponderous pine forest at the Front Range base. So Mount Chautauqua rose directly above and behind the plains, so to speak.
So pretty near today's I-25 corridor?
No, because the highway from Colorado Springs to Denver ran through Palmer Lake. It took a westward bend toward the mountains just north of Monument. And north of there, the highway went up to, I can't think of the little town's name, but the old highway converged on the new freeway, which had not, of course, yet been built then. And the highway, I remember, had Bermashave advertising signs along it. And those things are, I guess, collectibles today. They haven't been seen in years. But I remember how one group of four of them actually read the text that the first sign said, a man, second sign, a miss, third sign, let's see, how did it go, I guess it was a man, a miss was all on the first sign, and then something about a kiss, I thought I remembered it exactly.
Mm. Trying to get people to slow down a little bit, or
it said something about it.
Pay attention to your driving.
He kissed the miss and missed the what? It probably can be looked up on the internet.
Yeah, I'm sure. So when you were seventh grade, it sounds like you left Los Alamos. What happened from there?
We ended up going to Timnath, Colorado, east of Fort Collins.
How do you spell that?
Timnath. That's a biblical name, something to do with Samson.
Okay. And what was going on out there? Was that farming again?
It was around Timnath at that time, yes, surrounded by rather beautiful farmland and many irrigation ditches on the Poudre River of cottonwood.
Oh, on the Poudre.
Yes. And, Timnath, my father was the principal of the school there, high school. And let's see, I misstated that. We weren't in Timnath then yet. We were actually in Fort Collins, and Timnath was later anyway. I'll get back to that later on.
Okay.
So we lived three places in Fort Collins for those 2 years, and I went to junior high school there at Lincoln Junior High, which is near downtown, or used to be near downtown.
So that, I kind of think that might have been a big jump, because I think Los Animas would have been a tiny little quiet town, but I don't know that Fort Collins was that way.
Yeah, actually, it was rather a strain on me. I had trouble getting used to the size of that school, and the school had its cliques of different people, and I wasn't especially popular with any of them, I being rather a loner, and I began to do bird watching in the vicinity. It had lakes with cattail and sedge margin for the grebes and coots nested and so on. And so
who did you do the bird watching through? Was there a local club that kind of inspired or encouraged you, or did you just do that on your own?
That was entirely on my own, plus access to the city library, which at that time had a copy of Sclater's History of the Birds of Colorado, published in 1912, I think.
Wow.
And so that was my initial bird book. And Sclater was big on egg collecting, and I thought, well, that must be what ornithologists do. So I started a fairly extensive collection of eggs, which actually was illegal. I didn't know at the time.
Wow.
I began to do it, but unfortunately something happened in one of my later moves and the collection has vanished. I know not where.
Oh my.
But in any case,
okay,
I doubt if I did enough of that at that time to have a significant impact on the bird populations, which have gone down a lot around Fort Collins since that time. And in fact, in my opinion, Fort Collins was just about right when I was in junior high school there, and I only wish it had stopped development then.
Yeah.
Become what all of that region is today.
Yeah, yeah. And also, again, moving from the flatlands, the farmland, to basically walk out your front door and look to the west and see a giant mountain. Did you get up into the mountains at all at that time?
At that time, I don't really remember getting to do it. I'm not sure why not.
Okay. And was your dad teaching at the Lincoln Junior High?
No, he taught at the high school itself.
Okay. Because I wondered what it would be like to be a student of a parent who is either the principal or teaching at the school. You'd be known as, you know, Principal So-and-so's kid, or, you know, how that might work out. And maybe that was in Timnath where that would have happened.
Well, actually in Timnath, I was already in college.
Oh, okay.
But,
okay.
There was then an interval when I would have gone into what was the ninth grade in junior high there, and how did that go now? Eighth and ninth grade were both in junior high in Fort Collins. My father had taken the job as the superintendent of the school at Fairplay, Colorado, which was high in the mountains, 9,800 feet. So in between my final 8th grade year in junior high and the 9th grade, which happened in Fairplay, we moved up to Fairplay.
So I'm trying to think about Fairplay. Isn't that a mining town?
It was indeed a mining town, and at that time about 400 population is all that were left living there.
Wow.
But I did begin to go out in the mountains around Fairplay most of the time all by myself. I was rather a loner in that period, and I had not gotten along well, really, in junior high in the city. So I resolved on my own initiative that, although I had reservations about what it would be like to live in a mining town or in the mountains, all the things I'd ever read about such places were there, tough, and everybody up there is tough, and I feared I might have trouble getting along there, but I decided to go out of my way to actually talk to the fellow students that I was joining, and my graduating class was only 12 people.
Wow.
But actually, I was relieved that I found that my eccentricities, as such as they were, seemed to be better accepted in Fairplay than they'd been in Fort Collins. The kids there were not nasty, not tough, and needlessly cliquish or anything like that. And
nice.
I made a couple of friends there, and so I ended up being better off, although the climate was a little, not a great deal to my liking.
if you didn't like skiing or snowshoeing, sort of winter snow activities, I don't know what you would do.
I never learned skiing. Actually, the summers there were fine, but the winters were comparatively low on snow. It's in the rain shadow of the other mountains to the west.
Huh.
So although it did snow, the worst of it was if you had to go somewhere across South Park in the winter, there could be ground blizzards that were really scary to drive through.
Wow. Okay.
But we had some. Well, basketball was the only team sport they had at Fairplay High School. It wasn't rich enough or had a season really suited to things like football. So there were occasional basketball games in other towns around that region. And they had one once over at Victor, which was half a ghost town at the time near Cripple Creek.
Okay.
And I didn't really care about the sport, so I wandered around the abandoned mills in town.
Oh, wow.
And I found a relic in one of them, a carbide miner's lamp. And I appropriated that and took it back. Somehow I knew what it had been. And I knew an old miner named Jack Moran in Fairplay. So I went to Jack Moran and asked him if he'd show me how to use the carbide lamp.
Oh, fun.
He was happy to do that. And so I laid that away. I was somehow intending to use it in the future. And
With the proximity to a large number of abandoned mines, did you go underground? Did you get attracted to see what's in there?
I was attracted, but somehow I didn't really feel like doing solo mine exploring.
Okay.
But a point of interest was that some of the kids who recently graduated from the high school were around at that time still, and I would listen to them talking about this cave that was said to be up in the mountains, several miles west of Fairplay, up a timberline, and which was said to go deep into the heart of a ridge and to have underground streams.
Wow.
Which were supposed to fluctuate. Some said that it would, or the one stream would flood at 3 in the morning every 24 hours, although they never said how they knew that. That would have been a day to be there.
Right.
Anyway, then the cave was supposed to terminate in a giant room that was big enough to hold the county courthouse. But at that time, none of these boys were inviting me to make any trips with them to it, so I bided my time, and then I graduated from high school out in 1956, having started in 53. And at that point, we moved again. My father took a job at Timnath, which I was prematurely trying to describe to you earlier.
And hey, Donald.
Yes?
Hang on a second. I want to kind of go back to Fairplay just a little bit more.
Sure.
When you were at Fairplay, was your father working at the high school there?
Yes.
Okay, so there would have been a situation where you were the... Was he the principal of the school?
The whole superintendent for the county, I think.
Superintendent for the county. Wow, okay. So he wouldn't necessarily have been in your school every day. If he was superintendent, he would have had a lot of...
Well, no, he was every day. Actually, that was the only high school in the county, I think, at the time.
Oh, okay.
So he was, and he was also the chemistry teacher.
Okay.
And I could tell about an explosive adventure there. It happened that one day my father had been demonstrating to us the flammability of different elements and materials in potassium chlorate, or mixed with potassium chlorate, and we tested potassium chlorate and sulfur, and that would flare and make sulfur dioxide, and with charcoal, and it would flare also, and these being ingredients of gunpowder. And then I decided to try something else with red phosphorus powder.
Ooh.
And very luckily, we mixed that in a relatively safe way, and then Red Spencer, one of my students follows, set an evaporating dish with about a cubic inch of this mix down in a deep laboratory sink, and flipped a match into it from above. And it's a doggone good thing that we hadn't been holding that or even had it open nearby us, because it blew, it detonated.
And wow.
Pieces of that little porcelain dish were in every corner of the room.
Oh, my gosh.
They'd been directed upward by the walls of that sink, and people came from clear across the gymnasium on the far side of the school to find out what had happened over there. Was such a blast. So that really intrigued me. I tried to make homemade firecrackers and didn't have much luck with gunpowder. They would fizzle. But I found the perfect detonating explosive for making firecrackers. But I resolved to experiment more cautiously with it, and I had access to the entire school because of my father having the keys to it. So I went in one day when no one else was in there, and I took a cubic inch of those ingredients and put them in a little plastic gumball container, and I got a mahogany stick from the wood shop, 6 feet long, and attached it with rubber bands to the stick. And then I opened a window partway in a room between the school and another building a few feet over from it, and began to shake up this stuff to mix it. And sure enough, it spontaneously detonated and blew 6 inches off that stick without even being confined.
Wow.
And I sneakily drew the rest of the stick back in the window, closed the window, and went away from there. I was never caught, fortunately, but that taught me this wasn't a safe firecracker explosive, and subsequently I learned that's the mix that was used in making toy percussion caps for cap pistols.
Oh, wow.
If you let the hammer fall on a little eighth-inch blob of the stuff,
yeah,
then it would blow up and snap. But I had a larger scale explosive experience there in Fairplay not long after that. I had been up on the Level 1 mountain climbing around, and I went by an abandoned mine and looked in the old blasting powder shed, and there were half a dozen boxes of old dynamite in there.
Okay.
So I reported that to the sheriff, and the sheriff actually got in touch with Camp Carson, now Fort Carson, for their detonation experts to see what should be done with this dangerous cache of dynamite. And what they decided to do was to detonate it in place. So a couple of the Army people came, and the sheriff actually deputed me to guide them to the thing. So I did that, and they went up there, and they had blocks of TNT with them. So, as I recall, they took 8-pound blocks of TNT and laid them on top of the dynamite very carefully, rather than attempting to move the dynamite. And then we retired to a safe distance, as the firecracker labels used to advise, and which happened to be behind a virgin spruce tree trunk 100 yards down from the shed. And when that went off, it blew that shed to just fragments, and we heard things go whining through the woods around us.
Wow.
It must have been the nails and the metal hasp off that shed.
Huh.
And when we went back up there, we found a crater 3 feet deep and 12 feet wide where the shed had been.
Wow.
And so that was fun, and we drove back down the mountain, and there was this old lady who lived in Park City below the mountain at that time, and she came out of her house shaking her fist at us. And evidently the sheriff hadn't told any locals that there was going to be an explosion there, so he had to presumably mollify this lady and had and admit that it was his own orders that should be done.
Okay. When you were in 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, were your parents saying, "Donald, when you go to college," or was college never even mentioned in your...
No, it was mentioned, and in fact, I'm fairly sure that's why my father moved to Timnath, because then I could be near the college where I'd been accepted, Colorado A&M, without having to live there on the campus and spend more money. And so we moved down there, and let's see, I In the meantime, that summer of 56, I'd had the first actual job I ever took beyond being a gopher for the newspaper editor in Fairplay and an usher for the theater, which they still had one there. And so I applied. I had made very good high school grades.
Okay.
And I needed to take that test, what's it called?
The SAT test?
I think so. And I remember being driven to Colorado Springs at that point to actually take the test. And I guess I aced it. I did very well in it. And then I applied to Colorado A&M, which later was CSU.
Okay.
And I also applied for scholarships at that time. And I actually got two scholarships. One, I think it was $500 Becher scholarship.
Wow.
And then a $5,000 National Merit scholarship, which was the first year they'd been given.
Wow.
And I think they probably wanted to show that they weren't just focusing on city people and so on for that honor, and that they decided, well, Donald Davis looks like a good rural candidate, small-town candidate for the scholarship, and scored highly enough, so I will give it to him.
Gosh, that's a $5,000 in 1956 was a substantial sum of money.
Yes, it paid my entire college expenses other than room and board with my parents.
Wow. Nice.
I studied biology, biological science.
Was biology something you had been interested in? I mean, you got into birding.
Yes. As a matter of fact, in Los Animas, my father's college textbooks were still in the bookcase, and I read his botany textbook of considerable interest at that time, so I'd already familiarized myself with the basics of college-level botany in particular.
Okay.
And then when I took the test, I had to go to a basic botany course that had, I think, 300 people in that one lecture room in college. So I took that.
Wow.
And the teacher at that time told me later that he was pretty sure that I would either fail abysmally or succeed royally, because he noticed that when the other students were taking notes, I wasn't. And that was actually quite deliberate, because I figured I already knew much of what I had expected to be taught in college there in that course. So I was better off to just pay attention when he was talking.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed that the students who were taking notes were having to divide their attention and miss part of what the teacher was saying.
Oh, interesting.
I didn't think that was logical. So I did that, and sure enough, he told me I got the highest grade that had ever been gotten in that course.
Wow. And well, I don't know if it was true back then, but I mean, I'm 20 years behind you in schooling here, or younger. And those classes with 300 people in them were called weed them out classes, and they were intentionally tough to kind of get rid of people who didn't have the drive or the intelligence to kind of fight a little bit to succeed. Was that class, that botany class, sort of the same genre?
I didn't have that impression myself. It was pretty basic, I thought, and
okay.
Maybe in places like Harvard, they might have made such things happen. I don't really have any knowledge of it.
Okay, all right. And did you enjoy the botany class?
Well, relatively, yes. And most of the other classes, I did feel tense in college. I worried about grades and so on, and it never occurred to me that in some places people would just party in college and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, what was my main benefit in the long run from college was they had a hikers club, and I'd never been able to find an organization before to do things like that, and so I immediately joined the hikers club when I got there and
Donald,
some real climbing.
Hang on a second. Let's back up a little bit. You mentioned that when you graduated from high school, I believe that would have been in the spring of 1956.
You're right.
You got a summer job, and I we kind of bypassed that. I was curious to know.
Well, that was before I went to college. That was for the USGS on there completing the quadrangle, 7.5 quadrangle series in South Park. I was a rod man for 3 months while they were doing the field completion for that.
Wow. Okay, so tell me what was involved with that.
Basically, finding the original section corners when they could be found, and they were usually just rock piles that a few might have brass caps, and then holding the stadia rod, as it was called, while they sighted from a long distance away from a bench point in order to properly locate the section corner or subsection corner.
So were you setting corners, the brass caps, in concrete? Or
I wasn't anyway. They might have, but I don't remember them doing that.
Okay. So
I was driving more than anything.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, as a rod man, they would basically set up a foresight. You would occupy that site, then they would move in front of you and then turn back to you. Is that?
That's how I recall it, yes. They would tell me where to be, and then they'd go where they wanted themselves.
Okay. So that got you exposed to the fundamentals of surveying anyway.
Yes.
Okay. And got you outside and hiking up and down a little bit, I would think.
Well, it did, you know, all right, although I really disliked that job because those particular two people were not pleasant. They seemed unhappy in their work. And,
oh.
And they, I just...
Okay.
I was glad to have it over with, and that they gave me a suitable recommendation.
Okay. And so that was a temporary position with the USGS?
Yes, just a summer seasonal thing.
Well, do you remember what your pay was, your hourly pay?
Probably at that time, GS-4.
GS-4, okay.
Though I don't recall what that meant in money then.
Okay.
Later on, I did some other federal jobs at that grade.
Okay, so now let's go forward again. And this would have been the hiking club. Was that the Colorado A&M Hiking Club? Did it have a name?
Yes, our Hikers Club. I don't know what its name was. Colorado A&M Hikers Club. And they were able to teach me basic rope work and so forth. And
oh, there was more than just walking around.
Oh, yeah. There were a number of quite ambitious young outdoorsmen developing in that club. The best known of them in later times was John Vincent Hellman, which you might or might not have heard of.
Tell me about him.
He was a very charismatic young man, one or two classes ahead of my year in college. and very strong and energetic, and he was frequently a leader of the hikes and climbs at that time, although he sometimes seemed rather self-centered and would go off when people couldn't keep up with him, and he might leave them in the lurch sometimes. But he and I got along very well, and we became basically best friends of anyone I was in college with.
Okay.
But there were others like Ray Collier and Al Spencer. And Al Spencer was actually a biologist later on at Fort Lewis College in southwestern Colorado.
Okay.
He only recently died. They lived in Durango for a long, long time.
Okay.
His wife and son are still living.
Okay. Donald, let's go back for a minute. I wanted to catch up another loose end. When you were in high school, you were hearing the older boys that had graduated talk about this cave up above Fairplay. Did you get into that cave at this time, or is that going to come along later?
I did at this time, yes. It was one of the first wild caves that I had been able to visit, and I knew of it, and finally there were a few people in the Hikers Club that were interested in caves. And in 1957, I visited my first one, which was Table Mountain Cave in southern Wyoming on a private ranch land and no longer legally accessible. But that was a 40-foot rappel into the cave and prusik out.
Okay.
So I got to start using my technical training during that period.
Let's just stop right here for a minute. When I think of prusiks, today, of course, we have these amazing ascenders. You snap them on the rope, you step in the little loop, you tie it around, and you're good to go. And then when I think of prusiks in 1957, this is a special type of knot that can loosen up and go up a rope, and then when you load it up, it grips the rope and stops.
Exactly so.
And you kind of tie this thing with shoelaces around a little stirrup on your shoe or your boot. And if you have to be careful because if you don't do it right, it can cause some problems.
Well, actually, your shoelaces are much too small.
Okay.
The optimal size was about 5/16 inch for the kind of ropes we were then using, usually 7/16.
No, I'm sorry. I was thinking that the shoelace helps keep the regular prusik line loop around your ankle. It keeps it from the loop from going out by your toes and your foot popping out of the loop.
Well, there are better ways of doing that.
Well, I'm dating myself. I'm sorry. back in our early climbing, that's what we did. But yes, there are definitely some better things.
So anyway, I did get to go to Cave Creek Cavern, and damned if they weren't right in high school. The timed water gushes were never confirmed. But it really did have a room that would hold the county courthouse.
Wow.
A three-story pioneer building. We measured that at 90 feet high, 50 or 60 feet across, and about 450 feet long up a slope.
Wow. How did you measure the height of that room?
I don't remember then. I think I'd read that in one of the early Colorado Grotto Caving publications.
Okay.
Since the organized cavers were already around in the 50s and had been there. Although, one time later, to confirm that, we took just balloons, hydrogen balloons in there.
Oh, wow.
And hoisted them to the ceiling and watched where they hit, and they measured the cord.
What a great idea. Huh.
Well, there's a man I knew in the Park Service at Carl's Red who actually used the same technique to climb to an otherwise inaccessible set of domes in Carl's Red Cavern. He used 100 party balloons to hoist a parachute cord over a stalagmite, and then you'd pull that down with a slightly larger rope attached until you were pulling the size rope you wanted to climb on.
Wow.
It worked.
That's amazing. That's just amazing. So the Cave Creek Cavern, were you in there in 1957, the same time you were in Table Mountain?
Either that or the following year, I forgot for sure. But the one that got really interesting then was Spanish Cave. Have you ever heard of that one?
No, sir.
That's in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains.
Okay.
South of the West Cliff.
Yep.
And close to four of the 14ers, which you may know, Crestone Needle, Crestone Peak.
I've heard of Crestone, yes.
Humboldt and Kit Carson. And,
okay.
So in 1958, well, we had been reading clippings, newspaper clippings, that said that there had been Spanish gold in this cave.
Okay.
That they had been there in the 1700s and left artifacts and skeletons chained to the wall.
Right.
This sort of thing. And the Hikers Clubbers the year before had actually looked for it, but it turned out that the clipping they were going by had a totally wrong location.
Hmm.
To the north of the actual Marble Mountain, which was the true location. So anyway, then they didn't find the cave on their first trip, but we had gotten to know a bit more about the location at that time. So in 1958, Vin Homan and I went to the cirque there, and the first day we climbed Crestone Needle and Crestone Peak. And that was, we did Crestone Needle via technical route that was full of pitons. And Crestone Needle, then the following day, Humboldt and Kit Carson. And on the third day, we climbed up out of Colony Creek and went south along Marble Mountain in order to find the caves. And we ended up finding 7 of them, and
wow.
Spanish Cave was actually the last one. We were initially overshooting them too high up the mountain. But on our way back, we had found one cave, which turned out to be Cave of the White Marble Halls. And we were puzzled because we hadn't read about that one, and we thought we were maybe in Spanish Cave. But we couldn't find the pit that was supposed to be in there.
Hmm.
So then we were getting in the late afternoon and began to contour back across the limestone outcrop heading for camp. And we ran straight into Spanish Cave entrance. And
How did you know it was the entrance to Spanish Cave?
Well, for one thing, it was blowing the strong wind that all the articles
told
of. And for another, we crawled in there. We just had flashlights with us. And in 40 feet, we came to the pit, and which dropped down into an indefinite depth and cold, 36 degrees in there.
Oh, wow.
And I remember feeling kind of a sense of the sinister then. This is scary, let's get out of here.
Huh. Okay.
But I got over that then over the winter, and then I began leading trips to Spanish Cave the following summer, and I immediately started discovering Virgin Passage only 150 feet from where the Colorado Grotto people had turned back. And It turned out that everyone else had been so focused on the pit that was in the newspaper stories that they didn't think much about trying to go farther up the mountain from there. But I did, and I found that quite soon we were meandering through these high, narrow canyons that had absolutely no sign that any human being had ever traversed them. And then we came beneath these, what I called the first, second, and third great chambers, huge domes that rose up above the ancient stream cut slot. And it just went and went, and we devoted the following summers, and not just the Hikers Club people, but I had encountered people in the southern Colorado Grotto who were based in Pueblo, new cavers, and it happened that some of them came up on Marble Mountain when we were also there, and we were about the same age and level of knowledge and experience and enthusiasm, and so instead of being turfy and trying to order each other not to explore our cave, we joined forces and began to explore it ourselves with that many more cavers.
So, Donald, I'm going to jump in here. Could you tell me the name again and spell that out, please, of your climbing partner or your caving partner that you discovered Spanish Cave with?
John Vincent Hoban, known as Vin, and the last name is spelled H-O-E-M-A-N.
Oh, okay. So this is the same John Vincent that you mentioned when you first joined the hiking club.
Right. And his middle name, or rather his first name, was John.
Got it. John Vincent Hoban. Okay, got it. All right. Who you became good friends with, but not everybody did.
No, not everybody did, but some others did too.
Okay, so
the better climbers did.
Who were the climbers with the Southern Colorado Grotto that you recall?
They were cavers, not so much climbers. And,
oh, okay.
I know their names well enough, except that my retrieval mechanism is
no worries.
Faulty.
No worries. Let's regroup for a minute here, because I would like to spend a little time. We've kind of gone ahead in the timeline with the caves. Let's go back to 1957, that fall, winter, and spring into 1958. How did your schooling go there?
Well, I got pretty much straight A's in everything but physical education.
Okay.
Which I'd never had to take in grade school.
Okay. Were you in any sports, or was it just simply, college was college, and you wanted to get a degree in biology?
I had absolutely no interest, and never did, in competitive sports.
Okay.
Even though my father was a teacher of that, and in that regard, I suspect I was a disappointment to him, but he...
I wonder, did he ever say anything about that, or...?
Not about that, although he did say one other thing that bothered me a lot and made me less close to him, namely, I would later realize that I was gay.
Okay.
But in junior high and high school, I hardly even knew that other people could be lusty for other males.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a subject of frustration in school. I would like to have been far more intimate with many of the students than I dared to be.
Right. But that seemed normal for the time. I mean, now it's like ho-hum, but back then, you know...
Yeah, I know, but what my father did once was... I remember we were in a car driving somewhere, and he just burst out with no particular reason. reason, homosexuals should be executed.
Wow.
And I was pretty sure I was a latent form of that. And
okay.
I never did come out to him after that. I didn't want to be disowned as someone deserving execution.
Right.
And that, I think, was a major latent influence on my later life in general, that I was an outsider in that respect, and I think I was also an outsider, partially an extension of my sexuality, and I never got to identify myself with gay institutions later on, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because by that time, I'd already invested my personal passion in outdoorsmanship and particularly caving and
mm-hmm.
climbing. And, so that came first, and sexuality came next.
Yeah, understood. I'm curious, did you ever speak with this to your mom?
No, I didn't speak to my family at all about it.
Okay.
Although I surmise that my brother, whom I'd originally been close to, may well have been as well, because he never made any effort to involve himself with the women that I know of.
Okay. All right. Interesting. Yeah, just it's such a different time. And still, I mean, it's not easy today, but it's just different for individuals, you know, to explore their sexuality in ways that are not traditional. Yeah. Okay, and so as you worked your way 57, 58, and I kind of want to stay tight to the timeline here as you start exploring these caves, were you still focused on, okay, I'm going to get my degree in biology?
Well, I got it.
Okay.
Caving by then had taken such priority that I actually skipped my college graduation ceremony so that I could attend the 1960 National Speleological Society Convention, which was to be held at Carlsbad that year.
Oh, wow.
And they had made it known that one might be able to do off-trail trips in Carlsbad Cavern.
Ooh.
Which at that time was a very big deal. They hardly ever opened the off-trail sections to outsiders. So I just had to do that, and I actually paid $10 penalty fee for skipping the graduation ceremony.
Wow.
But I don't regret that in the least.
I bet not.
A lot developed from that spring.
You know what? I'm thinking, Don, this might be a good place to put a comma in this oral history. I would like to pick up next time in 1958 and learn a little bit more about your initial journey into Spanish Cave and some of the other caves that you found there north of Marble Mountain. Does that sound like a good idea?
Yeah, I can keep going if you want.
No, we've been at it. Let's see, let me look here. We've been at it an hour and 10 minutes, and that's a good time to stop here. And we've got, we kind of, just to make sure we know where we are, is there anything in this first part that I didn't ask you or that you were thinking you wanted to add of the ground we've already gone over?
Well, it might be the right point to interject my first had homosexual feelings, and that would have been at age 5 when we were moving into Eugene.
Oh.
I remember watching a boy about my age running through a sprinkler in just trunks, and I remember feeling a certain attraction. I would later consider sexual, just watching him do that. So
nice.
I am one of those who considers that if it's not inborn, it certainly starts very early having this orientation, that it's not something that you put on and off like a so-called lifestyle.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for bringing that in. Appreciate that. Okay, well, with that, let us conclude part one of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Donald Davis. Today is Monday, January 23rd, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Donald, thank you so very much.
It's been a pleasure. It's always good when someone is actually interested in what I used to do.
Well, lovely. Well, with that, hang on a second, and to be continued.